Session number 26590.
General Moore, Rule 3. You were saying that on the morning of the 9th of April you had to evacuate your base at Vernes rapidly. What was the first thing that you knew about the war coming to Norway on that morning?
Well, I'd only know that we were scrambled middle in the night. And brought back, and as I said, you had to do this with the airplanes and change the things. And
change.
Of course, that was an all effort do, so everybody had to take part. And so we mustered and flew off as soon as we could, and that was about, say, 6 o'clock in the morning. And at that time, we actually met German airplanes on the way, coming up towards that area. That was Ju-52, so I could almost say they weren't all that dangerous there then. They weren't fighters. But anyway, this is the first thing we saw them. We landed on a lake a little south of Trondheim. We didn't fly first, but we stayed there just until the afternoon. Then German airplanes came in, flew into Trondheim, and actually occupied the airfield over there. So we got out at the right time, you see. And we were up on this, they flew over the head, and as I say, they weren't fighter planes, but that was just a question of time. We knew that. We knew what airplanes they had, and they had to, they would come. So anyway, we couldn't be there, and also it was a place, it was a lake that was accessible by road from down there, so it was a question of time before the Germans would come down on this lake. So we moved up to a lake further inland called Røros, which is oh, how much? 100 miles south of Trondheim, I would think. That's on a very high area. It's actually on the top of the crossing of the mountain.
Near the watershed. Was it near the watershed?
It was very high, yes. High air, but we landed on the lake, of course, frozen
yes.
Lake. And we took into a farm there. And we saw these German airplanes, and they started being more, and we heard all this back and forth on the radio. So there was very little to orient yourself on. And the way how the war went and so on. Quisling was on the radio and saying that all this business of mobilization and so on was all nonsense, you know, and that you should stop fighting and so on. But up to that, we didn't have done much fighting. We'd been merely around, getting away.
Was there any effective air defense at Vernes? Did you have?
Well, there were so little, and they didn't really make much difference at all. The Vernes were taken fairly at the end, but it was such a peculiar kind of war. After a few days, I decided we had an accident with the airplane, with one Fokker. It tipped up, and then we tried to salvage it and so on. And you were in a sort of halfway of peace and war. My commanding, I was number two there, he disappeared to Trondheim to find out, you know, what did the army want us to do? There we were, you know, we were after all a part of the army, and the 5th Division, as it was called, that was the Trøndelag Division. We had no word from them, we had no directive really from anywhere. So it was a question of, you know, if you don't get it, you've got to find it. So he went there, but he disappeared. We never saw him again. So I had to take command of that group at that time. This was the third day, I think, after the war.
What means of communication did you have from that base on the lake and the mountains?
Pardon?
What means of communication did you have?
A telephone. We had that's all. And of course we had the problem of petrol, simply petrol. So we had to ration very much what we were doing. But I flew down to Vernes myself. I flew down to the lake where we had been intermediate, I got a car, I drove into Valdres, and there was a German guard and a Norwegian guard on the edge of the airport. I went right through them, I had a uniform on and so on, and went to see the commandant there. And he was living in a sort of idea about that got to go accommodation with the Germans and so on. It wasn't a personal thing. He was more or less led to do that. And as an example, there was even at that early time, the Germans were wanted to expand the airport at Valdres for their use, and Norwegian civilian labor under entrepreneur leadership and so on, they flocked to the place. Of course, high salaries, there's been layoffs and so on for a long time, and this was and they were encouraged by the authorities to do this. This was available work and so on.
Golden opportunity.
No. So it was a kind of a funny war. And I remember that I talked for a while with the commandant there. He was, as a pre-war fellow, he was a good fellow. No, he wasn't much help to me, but he explained how the Germans had settled themselves on the airfield, as far as where they lived and, where the airplanes were and so on. And we had the fortress that was held by active Norwegian elements just towards the Swedish border. And I thought at the time that this would be of interest to the people there with their artillery. So I went back to the car. There were two of us, actually. We were driving out on the other side of the airport, airfield, through similar kind of guards. They saluted, and we just went on. Came up to this place where they were embedding, you can say, where they're trying to make the fortress active in a proper way. I talked with the commandant up there. He was living in a, then of course it was late, very late then, and he was living in a hole in this old fortress where water was this high, and I had to get sort of
up your knees
to walk in. I was sitting on his bed there. That was just, the water was just in. And we talked for a while. He was an artillery man, a gunner, a well-known officer in the army. He had been a teacher in artillery at the academy, actually. And we were talking. I told him just exactly where all these airplanes were, where they were, so on. And he said, well, you see, my main worry is that I can't really get the range. So he was moving, and mind you, at that time on that fortress, all the guns were pointing to Sweden because it was made in before 1905. funny thing, but in fact, that relationship with Sweden is funny in so many ways. We were building fortresses against Sweden. But anyway, he had to, and he could gain about a small kilometer by taking those to the far east and moved them to the far west within his area. And so he was busy doing that work. But even then, he said, the load is not big, and he was wondering how much load he could dare himself to put on for reaching that distance.
He wasn't sure his guns would take the charge that would give him the range.
What the portier was, and so on. And, but he being a gunner, of course, he looked at that as an interesting artillery problem at the same time. But there was high spirit up there, I must say. Lots of volunteers and things and so on. But then, of course, the Germans set down hard on them, and it wasn't a lasting thing. Mm. And in fact, they, as I've been told anyway, they tried to reach and couldn't quite make it.
Couldn't quite get their shells onto
get
the airfield.
That range, So they didn't do any harm on the Germans.
Did you get any orders when you went to Fairness and you talked to the commandant there? Did he give you any orders
to do? No. But anyway, I was squadron commander myself then.
So yes.
But anyway, I got back late at night, and of course it's getting fairly light nights when you get into April. and I flew back to up there. But then, because we had the problem with that airplane, we had to move into an area where you had a drier bottom. So we moved into the other side of the lake. It's a fairly big lake. And there was, then we were not on ice. We were on a sand area, flat area. So there was no over water underneath the snow. But of course there was just as much snow. And we had the same trouble that when the afternoon came and the sun had really worked, the snow gets rotten and the airplane sinks in. So it limits what we can do in the flying way. But and we had to do something about that. And we had no equipment for getting snow
flattening the snow
or anything of that kind. But then we heard about this flock of reindeer that was coming up from Finland, which is a lake further south, and they were moving every year. It was domestic reindeer, and it was a sort of a combined ownership. So there was a big number of them, about 3,000 in fact, and they were being herded from that lower area and up in the mountains where they should be all summer. And so we got this fellow who herded them to make a detour and come by where we were. And there he came, you know, with all these reindeer, you know, walked in on the airfield we had. And reindeer, so now they have two claws like that. And as the snow gets harder, these claws come together. So it gets like that. We got a perfectly stamped area. And then when he had done about three circuits like that, he just moved off. That, of course, was fine right away. But then, as soon as the sun started next day, instead of having 5 or 6 feet of snow, we had this much of snow, you know.
About 18 inches.
That sort of thing. Yeah. And although it was hard stamped when they did it, the sun had it work, and bushes and so on started coming up like that, you know. And so we had to go around with knives and whatever we found, tools and so on, to
clear the vegetation.
Anyway, that's the way it was. It was an incident. But at that time, we did fly, I would say, a fair amount. We had to ration ourselves. In fact, we flew much more with the Moth than we flew with the Fokker, because they were using more gas. So we took the gas and the fuel from the Fokker to the Moth and used that. But when I think about what we actually did, I don't claim that we were all that important.
What were you actually doing when you were flying? Were you doing
reconnoitering? Well, we had an army fellow who was a captain and was in charge of the army. He stayed at Røros, which was the closest point. Mm. And he sort of had ideas about letters, we should do that and do that, you know, and he should fly as an officer there and he should... And maybe it was important, maybe it wasn't. I never claimed that this was a... It wasn't really a thing. We did... We had a fellow who went to skis, one of the squadron members who went on skis to Sweden to fix up a help for that fortress that I'd been to in the way of food and medical things and so on. And he succeeded. They even got some railway... wagons on the spot where this fort was, but at that time they gave up, so it didn't come to practical use. And if you ask me what we did of useful, really truly useful things, I say we were ready, spirit was good, despite everything. But when you talk about usefulness, I have hesitation on claiming anything at all, really.
But were you able to arrange for any resupply of petrol to keep the aircraft going?
Well, we just didn't have it.
You didn't
we
get
had
it.
To go into a civilian car place. And of course, you couldn't use that for the Fokker. You could use it for the other. Also, it was because of octane numbers.
So you could use civilian car fuel to keep the Tiger Moth flying. It would fly. The Tiger Moth could use ordinary civilian
petrol. Yeah, we use that more than we had two of those.
What did they...
And we had no mechanics with us.
You didn't?
No.
Was it just pilots then?
We were just flying up there. So we were living on what the... we did ours. Well, of course, we had some training in basic things.
Survival training.
We had... it was... anyway, it didn't last all that. And it was a very confusing period. You know? There was a lot of rumors going and on. And, of course, the Germans came closer and closer. And we got fighters up in the area. We didn't find... We had to camouflage these things. And we had a lot of work. And maybe that.
How did you camouflage the aircraft? What did you do to conceal them?
Well, we, of course, you could paint them.
Yes.
With various sort of things. And particularly because they were dubbed green, as you would have about them. You had to paint them so they more camouflage themselves in the snow.
Yes.
So we got some chalk and things, you know, for that, and did that. And then you cut down bushes and things and lean over them and right on the side. Hard to hit the trays or things. But we weren't actually attacked by the Germans, no. But that was just a question of time, and we knew that perfectly well, that they were getting pretty close, actually, on the ground, as it was. But at that time, we got orders we really have a choice. Came a plane from Lesja, which is further to the west coast of Norway, still in the high mountains area. And that's where the British had landed with their gladiators. And we had a little Norwegian Air Force command set up there with Major Uhren, Bjarne Uhren, as he had. And I got a message sent to me from him, came with a flying in there with a moth, saying that I had a choice, really, and I should ask the pilots about their choice, which was either to join him and go to Britain and hopefully get new equipment and come back up north in Norway, or they could take whatever plane we could muster and go north themselves and be with the squadron up there. But he wanted this to be a free choice of the individual, and so it was for me too. But actually, it dissolved the squadron there, so most of them went up north. And they flew with what we had, and I went to that Lesja where he was. I had a bullet hole from a place in between on the Germans had come that close. And so I lost fuel on the way, and I had to force land up in the mountains there. Pretty shaky thing altogether. But anyway, that was successful. I had a mechanic. We had one mechanic who had come after us and joined us. And he was the old mechanic at the flying school. In fact, he was really an old pilot too, but he was one of the great old characters. He was with me in that iron ring behind. And we landed up there, and I said, no, we've got to have this repaired. You look after that, and I'll go and see if I can get some petrol. And this was a fair amount of walking on skis. We had all the skis in the airplane. So he was left with the airplane on the flat area where he had landed. And I went off, and funny enough, I got to an hotel up there, the tourist hotel, got a telephone down to Dumbos, where it was about 15 kilometers, 10 miles, something like that away. I got an Air Force major on the phone who was there, and I said, I need the fuel. And he said, sure, I can get you fuel. And I said, how quick? And he said, how long is it, you know, and I can get it. It's an amazing thing, you know, the Air Force had stored some cans of fuel. And, you know, I was waiting for him, and there he came with a horse and sledge and things, you know, and a lot of cans. It's amazing, you know. It really is, you know. But then it was a question of getting that into the airplane.
Yes.
And so we had the horse couldn't go, and we got some sledges. And I'll tell you, that was a hard working.
You're having to haul aviation fuel on sledges
and
over
the
ground.
The sun was standing down.
Yes.
And this was a late afternoon.
Mm.
And we managed. We got some help.
Yeah.
And so on. We managed, got them and dragged them on sledges. And by that time, that fellow in there, his name was Helland, he had managed to fix that hole in the fuel tank.
Mm.
And how he fixed it, I don't know. It might be a chewing gum, as far as I know. Mm. But he fixed it, and we filled it. But then there were some cans on top of that. So we thought, we can't spill that. So that was put in the fuselage, and inside the fuselage. And he was so lucky, because he thought he had had enough of this war. So he stayed away. So I went with the fuel tanks, but without him, he went with the other fellow.
You left the mechanic who went back with the Air Force Major.
So I flew on and landed at Lesher. And this was a late land where the gladiators had been.
Yes.
But I landed the very day the gladiators had been bombed out. And that, I can tell you, was a dreary sight.
Mm.
And there they were, you know, you still see smoke coming up somewhere, and then you're standing there. Some had sunk, of course. And, it looked miserable, the whole thing. I landed out on the lake.
Were you in a Fokker?
In a Fokker. I was by myself then. And just as I landed and were going to taxi in, I saw three German Henkel 111 coming, and as they passed me, they were shooting at my airplane in a very uncomfortable way, I can tell you. And then they went up the valley, turned around, came down. I was the aiming point. I could see that. So I jumped out of this one, and I thought I should get away from the airplane, and that's where they were aiming at. But I sank down in snow like this, you know.
Up to your mid thighs.
Water on the bottom of the snow, I guess.
Yes.
I didn't get away from it. So they were passing, shooting, and went down that way, coming back again, passing, shooting. They didn't hit me, they didn't hit the airplane, and so on, and then they just disappeared.
What sort of level were they? Were they at very low level?
Very low, very low. In formation. And then my question, by that time, because I had stopped the airplane completely,
yes,
also the propeller, but to get that started again, is you need to be two.
Mm.
And I was there, and I thought I can't get in. It's steep and water on top. And a funny thing happened, that I sat up in the cockpit and moved the thing, and the propeller started going. So it's been just on the point where...
Point of balance,
So that was a very rare thing. But anyway, I got in. I got up I got the airplane right on. There was a little sort of track for where they sort of take timber down to the lake. I followed that. I came up on the main road that it goes to Åndalsnes, comes from south. And I was met by all that tremendous amount of troops, British and Norwegian and so on, withdrawing up that way, partly vehicles, partly marching, and very sodden thaw, a straight road. And about the first person I met was my own cousin. She was a wonderful woman, active as you can find them, medically education behind her. And she was a woman of very few words. She always was. I always liked her. And she said, "Oh, William, it's nice to see you, because I just met your brother down here." And I said, "What's he doing?" "Well, he is driving a truck and he has problems. I can see that," I said. "And I'm going so if you see him again, say that I'm going to see Ewan," and so on and so on. And that bye-bye, you know. And so I got to Ewan, and I was wet, of course, and so on. I changed, and I went to... Ewan said that He had been 12 or 14 officers around him, different ranks, and on senior to me, certainly, and or mostly anyway. And he said to me, could I go and find General Ruge, who was our chief of defense, and as you know, he was appointed during the critical period. And he was somewhere down the valley on the other side of the mountain. He didn't know where, but could I go and see him? And I often wondered later in life, you know, why on earth did he pick on me? I've had a long day, and he had other people around him. But anyway, he picked on me. And I got a car, and there was a fellow with me, and he was driver, more or less. We had to go through all these people who
withdrawing.
Went away, and we had to fight with that. We had a good car. Mm-hmm. And we did find Ruge, all things, down at a place called Otta. He was sitting up on a farm. I'm quite sure that the government and all those people were in the surroundings, but I didn't see any of those. And I was sitting there, I was 22, as I said, at the time, and sitting there talking with him for a good hour up in the...
Were you supposed to do when you met
him? I was supposed to ask for permission to go to England for this group of UN.
For that group of officers?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, for whatever officers we could get from the Air Force.
Yes.
And UN couldn't do that without authority. Mm. So it was getting his authority. Mm. That was the purpose of it.
You said earlier on that you had a choice, either to go north in your aircraft or to go to Leszka and so on. Why did you decide to go to Leszka rather than going to the north of the majority of the squadron?
Well, I suppose I thought that this idea to go to Britain and get new equipment was a good idea. Mm-hmm. So it was, for me, it wasn't really a big question now. Mm. And
what impression did you get of
General some people Ruge? That maybe just didn't want to leave the country. You know?
Yes.
You never know. It was a free choice. Mm.
What impression did you get of General Ruge when you met him? What state was he in, and what did he say to you?
I suppose when I was picked, it might have something that I had met him before, but not much. I mean, I met him at the academy.
Yes.
On an exercise, but I mean, I didn't know him, and I was almost the youngest. So it was a thing. But anyway, he was there, and he was very calm. He gave me a great layout of the situation, what their intentions were, going north. He told about the British having to pull out. He explained that obviously that we all knew incidentally, but the fact that they just couldn't survive with the German developing their air power the way they did, there was no staying possibility at all. For the ships and the supply line, not least the supply line, the warships can take something, but the supply line can't take much. So they had to give up and then go north. And he said that this idea about keeping Trondheim area with from two sides and so on, that wouldn't hold. By that time, this fortress that I talked about had collapsed. And so he didn't give any more help than getting up north and stretching time. But anyway, it was okay for us to go to England. But he also said that he had great doubts that we would be successful in getting new equipment and also the training that takes into new equipment and the sailing time to get to North Norway while it was still possible to be influential up there. But he wished us good luck, I remember. And then he added, and that's interesting, he said, whatever you do when you get there, in wishing us luck, he said, that try to keep identifiable Norwegian units, because that will stand very useful when the time comes of ending the war and the time comes to get a solution. So try to identify. Don't... He emphasized that, you know, wishing luck, but try to do that. We did exactly that, of course, later in the war. But I wouldn't necessarily say that it came because he said it, but he did say it. So it materialized anyway what he wanted. He was a very calm fellow. He had I remember him with great admiration. Really, his background in the army.